There we go. Welcome to the attendees. As you guys are coming in, it's good to see you all, or at least to know that you're there. We'll get going in earnest in a few minutes here. I think probably as soon as we start seeing questions in the Q&A, we'll commence. While everybody's coming in, welcome. This is Hugh Ross's Paradoxes class. In this first 15 minutes will be Q&A, and then we'll get into the webinar itself at about 10:45. So it looks like we got some chat. Howdy, Susan. Susan, are you able to get all panelists and all attendees? Yes, you are. Great. Thank you. That's good to see. All right. So if anyone has questions for Hugh, this is a good time to do it because you won't have much competition and he won't be in the middle of a webinar. So it looks like we already are starting to get one. Doug McComb has one and he's still working on it. Okay. So anyone else has a question, please do put it in. Lisa likes your shirt, Hugh.
All right. Thank you.
All right, Ryan has a question. It says, tomorrow there's going to be a paper published by Nature Astronomy in a press conference, and it looks like phosphine has been found in the Venus clouds. I've read that phosphine is difficult to produce abiotically. Could this be the first evidence of life on another world?
Yeah, I heard that there was going to be a major announcement. I didn't know what they were going to announce, so phosphine is it. If it's in the upper atmosphere of Venus, I can understand how it could be there biotically. Namely that the upper atmosphere of Venus has received a lot of Earth soil. When meteoroids strike the Earth, Earth soil gets exported throughout the solar system. The place where you're going to find it in the greatest density is the surface of the moon, but the place where you're going to find it in the second greatest density is the upper atmosphere of Venus. And if you go to a certain altitude, it'd be interesting to see the paper as to what altitude in Venus's atmosphere they found this phosphine, but there's a certain altitude where you get a temperature that's quite similar to what you see on the surface of the Earth. So if that's where it exists, a good chance it may be material from the Earth. Phosphine can also be produced abiotically. It's kind of like methane. The easiest way to make methane is with life on Earth, but you can also do it abiotically. The methane on Mars, for example, we now know is abiotic. As to really prove whether it's abiotic or biotic, you'll need isotope signatures. So for example, if we see that it has a higher ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-13 compared to abiotic phosphine, that tells us that it's very likely to be the product of life. So that's how we can sort it out. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the paper's actually got to say.
Great, thank you. Tony from Atlanta, Georgia says, I understand we're at the first point of the universe where advanced life is theoretically possible, but why is it not possible in the areas closer to the cosmic creation event, as it is older than our part?
Yeah, good question. And that was the subject of a couple of papers that have been published, just basically making the point that for life to be possible, you need certain elements to be available at a high abundance level. And you need those elements to be able to combine to make molecules. And the early history of the universe, all you got is hydrogen and helium. So you got to wait for stars to form to take that hydrogen and helium and transform that through nuclear fusion into carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, and all the elements, other elements you need for life. And these papers basically point out to get the necessary concentrations, you need to go through at least two generations of stars forming, dying, and then new stars forming and dying, and then you get a third generation of stars. So they're basically making the point, life is only going to be possible on planets that are orbiting the third generation of stars. And that's what takes the billions of years. And if you're really trying to talk about advanced life as opposed to microbes, then you got to wait another several billion years. I mean, the earliest time you can get microbes is about 9 billion years after the cosmic creation event. But if you want advanced life, then you need to wait another 4.5 billion years. So that kind of takes you up to the age of the universe. And the reason why is you're going to have to be in a planet that's able to have a long history of life. And that means you need a planet on which you've got a strong magnetic field that is sustained in a steady way for billions of years, and likewise plate tectonic activity. And that requires an even more fine-tuned abundance ratios of the heavier elements. You're especially going to need a planet that's super endowed with uranium and thorium and potassium, just to provide the heat that's necessary and to sustain that heat for a long enough period of time to make this possible. I'm actually writing a book on this now, making the point we may be on the only rocky planet that's small enough to be able to host advanced life with sufficient long-lasting heat flow in its interior that you can have a magnetic field and plate tectonics being sustained for 4 billion years. And what's interesting about our planet is what's going on in the core and what's going on in the mantle and the crust critically depend upon one another. There's a synergy taking place there. And so, you know, without the core, you're not going to get the plate tectonics. Without the plate tectonics, you're not going to get adequate heat flow from the core through the mantle. You really need the core, the mantle, and the outer core and the inner core and the crust all to be fine-tuned so that they can sustain the necessary energy exchanges that makes possible both a long-lasting magnetic field and long-lasting plate tectonics. And actually, there's another synergy you need to throw in there. You need to have life in great abundance on the surface of the Earth. You need to have an ocean that's a few miles deep on the surface of the Earth in order to sustain the plate tectonics. Life actually plays a crucial role in sustaining the plate tectonics.
Thank you for your question, Tony. Chris Thompson has a question from Anchorage. Seems that there is a burgeoning spate of scientific and non-scientific articles, some bordering on the sensational, about potential asteroids endangering the Earth. How would you place this in a biblical context, as well as a scientific probability context?
Well, I'm not far from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Quite a few members of our church are engineers and scientists that work at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and they have the task of monitoring asteroids and comets that could collide with the Earth, and of calculating the risk of such a collision and what kind of damage it would do. And they've been pointing out that they need to be sustained by taxpayer dollars, because the risks they're looking at are actually higher than risks that many of us take out insurance policies for. And so the Jet Propulsion Laboratory actually monitors tens of thousands of these asteroids and comets, and they assign a risk factor to the ones that have a possibility of impacting the Earth in the near future. They actually have a coded system of that risk factor. As to how this comports with what you see in the Bible, you know, what you see in Revelation chapter 8 is a prophecy, a biblical prediction that an asteroid will strike the Earth. And basically says this asteroid is going to strike the Earth and make one third of our drinking water poisonous to drink. And, you know, I remember many years ago, decades ago, actually, I looked at a map of the world and said, where would that thing have to hit in order to impact a third of our fresh water supply? And the answer is it would have to hit in the Rocky Mountain Trench. That's a place where about a third of the world's fresh water flows, the source of one third of the world's fresh water, for, on land at least. And right now, that water is not really being touched. You know, the Mackenzie River is the biggest river that flows out of that area, but you also get the Fraser and the Columbia. And those rivers rank in the top 10 rivers of the world. You also get the North and South Saskatchewan, the Athabasca, so the Stikine River, all flow out of that area. But very little of that water, I think the Columbia is the only river where that water is being tapped for electricity or for agriculture or for drinking water. The rest of the rivers, they just flow into the oceans, which tells me that I think that particular prophecy is not going to be fulfilled until the nations of the world say, hey, we're running short of the fresh water we need for various purposes. We need to start exploiting that untapped source. That is the world's largest untapped source of fresh water. And so once that gets tapped, I think that would set up what you see in Revelation there, chapter 8. Bottom line is it's not going to happen tomorrow. I don't think the stage is set for this to have a major impact on human society, which is kind of the context of what you see there in Revelation 8. They actually put a name. The name of that object that's going to strike the earth is called wormwood, which means bitterness. So the water is going to be kind of bitter and poisonous to drink. And people have asked me, are there any asteroids out there named wormwood? And the answer is no. But I could see one getting that nickname.
Doug McComb has a question. First of all, Doug, we do have this on record, so thank you for reminding us. And his question is there any possibility at all that someday, perhaps several hundred years from now, mankind will be able to travel past the speed of light, as with Star Trek's antimatter matter warp drives? How good is the science in the more recent Star Trek movies and TV series shows?
Yeah, a friend of mine actually published a paper on that. He's the chairman of the physics department at Baylor University. And I'm trying to think of his name. He actually reviewed my book, Beyond the Cosmos, and one other of my books. He was part of the team at Caltech that developed the first workable string theories for particle physics. But the paper he wrote, he said, okay, what do we need to do to be able to have a spaceship go faster than the velocity of light? And, you know, nothing can be accelerated beyond the velocity of light that's below the velocity of light. But what he pointed out is if we can somehow distort the space-time fabric of the universe, then we can go faster than the velocity of light without violating the principles of relativity. However, his paper pointed out you need an enormous amount of energy to be able to distort the space-time fabric in the vicinity of your spaceship sufficiently that you could effectively move across space at faster than the velocity of light. And I said, if you're trying to move something that's in excess of, say, 1,000 kilograms, which would be kind of the minimum you can even think of if you're trying to transport a human being, and actually you'd need something way more than that. But even something that's that light, in mass, he said you'd have to convert the total mass of Jupiter through E equals MC squared into pure energy every second to be able to make that happen. So bottom line, the paper, he said, you know, mathematically we can make it all work, but in terms of physical possibility, there is no physical possibility.
Thank you. Tony asks from Atlanta, Georgia, what does RTB have to say about the story of manna from heaven? Does this fall into the realm of transcendent miracles?
Yeah, we don't have any official paper or DVD on manna. We did do, from our TV show many years ago, a series on what we call mysteries. And that's a DVD you can see in the Reason to Believe store. We talked about Hezekiah's sundial. Excuse me. We talked about Jonah and the whale. We also talked about, Joshua's long day and a few other things that people think are mysterious that are in the Bible. But that one we did not deal with. Manna coming down from heaven. If it's coming down from heaven, and it is something physical coming down from heaven. And, people have speculated that it might have been flakes of food on certain trees that grow in the desert. I'm skeptical of that because those trees that grow in the desert that flake off, there's 5 million human beings plus. Because after all, we have the counting of the number of fighting men that were in the people that came out with Moses in the Exodus. And if you take that number and convert it to all the men, women, and children, you're looking at about 5 million people. Well, at least 3.5 million, but it could be upwards to 5 million. Trying to feed that many people within a small region, it has to be a supernatural event, in my opinion. This is God actually pouring down food. Moreover, the food that's coming down is a complete diet. These carbohydrate flakes that come off of certain, I think it's a myrtle tree within the desert, you're not going to get a complete diet. You're basically just simply ingesting the equivalent of sucrose. So that's not going to sustain you for 40 years. And also notice that it came down for 6 days. There was a Sabbath day where it didn't come down. So yeah, it is a supernatural event. God's doing something normal. Laws of physics.
Thank you, Hugh. I got another question from Juven from the Netherlands. How does the Bible view history? Are historical events shown as linear events that progress to one absolute direction, or more of an intertwined spiderweb, maybe like chaos theory?
Well, I think it's more intertwined. The Bible is chronological, but you're not going to have a chronology that takes you from Genesis 1 through to Revelation 22. Keep in mind it's 66 books that make up the Bible, and each book will have its own chronology. That may be independent of chronology you see in other books. The exceptions would be the historical books that you see, which you see there in Joshua, Judges, 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings, and 1st and 2nd Chronicles. Well, if you look at Chronicles and Kings, there is some overlap in the chronology there. And if you look like at a book of Revelation, when I did teach on the book of Revelation, I made the point that there's multiple chronologies in the book of Revelation. You can't read it as a chronology from chapter 1 to chapter 22. The reason why is that I believe the book of Revelation is a capstone, a summary, an addendum to all the Old Testament prophetic books. And each of those prophetic books has its own chronology. So it's not at all surprising when you read the book of Revelation, you get a chronology that runs for 2 or 3 chapters, and then it stops. Then the next chapter picks up a completely different chronology. And that's why when I taught the class, I kept referring back to the Old Testament, saying, okay, this part of Revelation is dependent on these chapters in the Old Testament. And let's look at the chronology there before we establish a chronology of what's going on in the book of Revelation. You say, why would God write that way? Well, it's a very compact way to write. If you were to write the same thing, you do see a general chronology in the different books of the Bible. So you've got the Torah, the 5 books of Moses. It's a basic chronology from Genesis through to the end of Deuteronomy. But then you've got the poetic books. which picks up a completely different chronology. And then, you know, you've got the prophetic books. You've got the major prophets and the minor prophets. In the New Testament, you've got the Gospels, the Book of Acts, and then the Epistles. And so there's a general chronology when you break it up into those sub-compartments. However, I pointed out in my book, Hidden Treasures, the Book of Job, that you actually get an earlier start to the chronology in the wisdom books than you do in the Torah. And so you have an earlier chronology in Job than you do, say, in Genesis 12 through 50. So just taking that into account, I believe that Job was the first composed book of the Bible, composed before Hebrew became a written language. So those are the complexities, but the beauty of it all is it can all be condensed into one book that we can easily pack around when we go to a church or a Bible study. I think God knew that it'd be very difficult for us to have a church and Bible studies if each of us had to bring a 35-volume set with us.
Hugh, I think that's it for the questions for now, about ready for your webinar.
Okay.
I think you have something special to work with us on today. Why don't you introduce that, and the webinar will be all yours.
Yeah, thank you. We've been trying to turn these virtual meetings into something that's more like the class that we used to run at the church. And incidentally, when we did run it at our church, we did stream it live. We did have this internet coexisting. But a lot of you said you'd really like to have some time with fellowship. I mean, what I remember about the Paradoxes class before we had the pandemic is that the time that people really enjoyed was after the class. I mean, people would hang around for an hour, even longer, just talking to one another and basically taking the content that we learned in the class and discussing it. We're going to try to duplicate that to some degree. And so what's going to happen today is I will give my half hour talk and then we'll have Q&A. But instead of going all the way to 12:15, we're going to end the Q&A at noon. And come noon, I already have the meeting set up. The advantage of webinar is the security it provides. The advantage of the meetings is just the engagement that it makes possible. You know, you can all see one another in full video, you can talk to one another. And so at noon, what I'm going to do is shut down the webinar and start up a meeting. And once we give people time to get into the meeting, I'm gonna break you up into small groups. And it's gonna be random. I got this set up for the next several weeks, so from noon. And I had to choose a limit, so it's noon to 12:30. But if I notice that the people are dropping out, we'll just end it earlier than 12:30. But if people are engaging one another, we'll keep it going to 12:30. And what I'm going to encourage all of you to do, I'll set this up. I'm going to give you a URL. I got it set up where there's no password required. All you need to do is the URL. And and it'll be the same each week. I'm going to ask you to keep that to yourselves or to someone that you trust. We're not going to broadcast it to the world. And if there becomes a problem, then I'll have to give a different URL every week. But hopefully we can set it up where we don't have to do that. And so once people get in there, I'll break up into small groups. And here's a challenge. I'm going to ask you to get to know one another, find out their name, where they're from, what they do for a living or have done for a living, where they are in their relationship with the Lord, whether they're seeking, they're a Christian, if they are, find out their testimony. And then each week I'm going to ask you to discuss some feature that was brought up in the class. And I'm not going to control it. Whatever you want to talk about, you can talk about. And I'm going to be part of it too. I have to be to keep the meeting running. But I'm going to be dropped into a different group each time. It's a great way for me to get to know you. And I can tell you this, there's some amazing people that are part of this class. So I really encourage you to be part of that feature. There's no obligation, of course. You can choose to join or whatever. So once we get into the Q&A a little bit before noon, I'll get that all set up for you. fact, I'll get it set up for you before we go into the Q&A. And we tried this once before, and it was too complicated. I think you'll find this a lot simpler. So that's a special feature. We'll see how it goes. And I've been told that Zoom is actually working on a feature where we can go seamlessly from a webinar to a meeting where you don't have to do anything. I don't have that software yet, but once it's available, we'll try that as well. So with that, let me share a screen, and we'll pick up where we left off last week on our series on the problem of evil and suffering, and particularly how God asks us to engage suffering and to use suffering for his purpose and his glory, as well as our purpose and our glory. So let me go to share screen. All right. Okay, all of you should be seeing the first slide. I mean, we're about three segments into our series on the problem of evil and suffering. And, you know, what I'm going to be doing today is basically picking up. Remember, we did that thing about, okay, atheists and non-theists will say the evil and suffering means that there can't be a God, because if God is all loving, he wouldn't subject us to all the suffering we're going through. And how I made the point, well, they're really underestimating the degree of evil and suffering that's happening within humanity. We humans are the only life forms on planet Earth that are sinners. And because of our sin, we actually magnify the degree of evil way beyond anything that natural process alone could explain. So what we're dealing with is we're living in a realm where the evil is so great, so extreme, that you can't explain it with thermodynamics or some kind of naturalistic evolutionary model. There must be something beyond. There must be something supernatural behind the scenes, where there's a supernatural good being opposed by a supernatural evil being or beings. And really the strategy here is, if you want to reach these skeptics and non-theists who are concerned about the problem of evil and convinced that this is an argument against the existence of God, the first thing that you need to do, or at least what I found effective, is to actually get them depressed. Get them to a point where they realize from their worldview perspective, there is no possible hope, purpose, or destiny. And as I mentioned last week, I had the privilege of taking a short course from Carl Sagan, and he began his course the same way he began his TV Cosmos series. The cosmos is all there is or ever was or ever will be. But the question we want to address, if the cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be, can it provide value, meaning, and purpose for humans? As I mentioned last week, we got in Ecclesiastes that phrase that God has written eternity on the heart of every human being. And I've noticed this in my debates with atheist scientists. Even though they believe there is no God, they insist that they have personal value, purpose, and meaning. And so I'm actually going to take you through a research paper that got published in the Astrophysical Journal. One written by a disciple of Carl Sagan, none other than Lawrence Krauss, probably one of the more famous atheist scientists here in the U.S. But back in the year 2000, he wrote a paper with Glenn Starkman, really addressing this whole question. If the universe is all that is or ever was or ever will be, can it provide value, meaning, and purpose? And by the way, I got the paper right here. If you want to take, and incidentally, this paper is available. You can go to the Astrophysical Journal, and you'll find the papers called Life, Universe, and Nothing, Life and Death in an Ever-Expanding Universe. And Actually, you can go to the NASA website, their archive website, adsww.harvard.edu, and you can put in Krauss in the search engine. He's only published 6 papers, and this paper will pop up. And the Astrophysical Journal makes available this paper free of charge to anyone. So you can read the entire paper for yourself. If you're a layperson, just ignore all the equations and read the text. The text is quite accessible to lay people, but I'm going to take you quickly through it so you can see what he was doing. We just started this last week, so I'll pick it up a little bit again. Excuse me. I may have a few asthma issues as I go through this. We're having terrible fires here in Southern California. I mean, it's kind of apocalyptic where we're looking. It's just like what you see in Joel chapter 2 and Revelation 6 and 8. The light of the sun, moon, and stars is dimmed by a third, and their light has been turned into color of like the blood of a corpse. That's what we're seeing here. The sun, the moon. I can actually look at the sun right now. There's so much smoke in the air. I can see the sun high up in the sky, and it shows up there as a bright orange-red disk. Earlier this morning, I tried to see if I could see sunspots. I wasn't able to do that, but it is causing me some issues. So I'm having to give myself a lot more steam treatment. So just bear with me if I do have to cough every once in a while. It's not COVID. It is productive. Okay. Last week, we made the point that this paper, Lawrence Krauss points out that we're now at a point where there's no doubt that our universe is dominated by dark energy. Dark energy makes up about 70% of the total stuff of the universe. And it's because our universe is dominated by dark energy that for the last 7 billion years of the universe's history, it's not only been expanding, but expanding at a progressively more rapid rate. Dark energy, if you're not familiar with the term, is the energy that's embedded in the space surface of the universe. And the way it operates is that space surface expands as the universe expands. That space surface gets bigger and bigger. As it gets bigger and bigger, this dark energy has more and more potency to accelerate the expansion of the universe. So every year that goes by, the universe expands at a more rapid rate. And Lawrence Krauss and Glenn Starkman begins their paper here by pointing out that this is going to be particularly depressing for astronomers because we now have telescopes powerful enough, we can look all the way back to the cosmic creation event 13.8 billion years ago. If you look 13.8 billion light years away, you're looking 13.8 billion years ago because of the finite velocity of light. And so you'll see this in a number of my books. I show you images of what the universe looks like at the moment it was created. But as we look that far away, what we notice is that the space surface of the universe relative to us is expanding away from us at almost the velocity of light. And so Krauss and Starkman make the point that in the relatively near future, it's going to expand away from us at greater than the velocity of light, which means we'll no longer be able to see the radiation from the cosmic creation event. And as time goes on, less and less of the universe will be accessible to us. And people last week asked me, when is this going to happen? Well, it depends upon the geometry of the universe, which we can only measure to 3 or 4 places the decimal. And so there's some uncertainty as to when things are going to shrink in terms of our field of view, but certainly in time, much less than a billion years. It could be even just tens of millions of years where we see the light from the cosmic creation event disappear from our point of view. And of course, as the universe continues to expand at a greater and greater rate, less and less of the history of the universe will be accessible to us. So there'll come a time, for example, when we won't be able to see the galaxies that were 3 billion years after the cosmic creation event. they will not be available for view. And actually, if you wait long enough, even the Andromeda galaxy will be expanding away from us at greater than the velocity of light. And so we won't see the Andromeda galaxy. And if you go into the extreme future, even the sun would be moving away from us at greater than the velocity of light. Although, as I mentioned last week, things are going to happen to the sun long before that happens. The sun's going to burn out. The sun in 4 billion years, a little more than 4 billion years, will expand to such a degree that it will vaporize our planet. So there are things that will happen earlier before that happens. Well, let me pick it up from there, because the second thing that Krauss and Stark would point out is that there reaches a point as the universe continues to expand where star formation will cease. The reason star formation will cease is when the universe expands, suddenly you're no longer going to have the molecules, the ordinary matter molecules in the universe, condensed enough to have the giant molecular clouds you need, dense molecular clouds you need to form stars. The universe will be expanding so fast that we're not going to have these molecular clouds of sufficient size and sufficient density to form stars. And this happens in the relatively near future of the universe. We're just talking tens of billions of years before we're going to see the necessary dense molecular clouds disappear. And then where the stars will burn out. So this is really looking at, okay, when will we no longer see stars? Star formation is going to cease in a lot less than a trillion years. Tens of billions of years, star formation will cease. But the small stars can burn for a long time. The smaller the mass of the star, the slower it burns and the longer it takes to go through its nuclear fuel. But after a trillion years goes by, all the stars will have burnt out. No new stars will be forming, which means we'll be living in a universe where we won't see any stars. The universe is going to be filled with dead stars. It's going to be filled with black dwarfs. Right now, we do see some stars that have gone through their nuclear burning cycle. We call them white dwarfs. Our star, the sun, is going to end its life as a white dwarf. It'll go through its fuel. And when it does, it's just going to gradually cool down. But it takes a long time for a burnt out star to cool down. Literally takes tens of billions of years. Matter of fact, the universe at 13.8 billion years is too young for there to be any black dwarfs. It takes more than those 14 billion years for a star to form, become a white dwarf, and cool down enough that it becomes a black dwarf. So that's one reason why we know the universe can't be much older than 14 billion years. We don't see any black dwarfs. The universe is too young for that. But a trillion years from now, you're going to look up at the night sky, there won't be any stars. Now that poses a problem right away, because if you don't have stars shining in the sky, you're going to have very little heat and light moving from hot spots in the universe to cold spots in the universe. And it takes that movement of heat and light from hot spots to cold spots for work to be possible. And so Krauss and Starkman made the point that you're going to get a significant diminishing of heat flow. And their paper is filled with, you know, really wild speculations about how very intelligent, technologically equipped human beings, or the equivalent of human beings, long after stars have ceased to shine, can capture the heat flow that happens at the quantum level or at the relativistic levels in such a way as to be able to sustain the necessary work to be able to keep us alive and to keep civilization going. But basically makes the point that once you get to 10 to the 50 years, the heat flow, even at the quantum level, becomes so tiny that there's no technological possibility of capturing that heat flow to sustain life or to do work. And having read the paper, I don't see any possibility of capturing this heat flow that they talk about at the quantum level. But they're speculating and saying maybe some future technology will be able to do that. But the problem with quantum mechanics is its unpredictability. And personally, I'm doubtful even with conceivably very advanced technology it could be done. But theoretically, they're right. Even if we were to develop that kind of technology, it's game over in 10 to the 50 years. So, that bottom one was supposed to come on later. My apology, I didn't get a chance to fix that. The fourth thing, which I found quite interesting in their paper, is that as the universe continues to expand, knowledge will decrease. And so they said the first humans that are going to be impacted by the accelerating expansion of the universe will be astronomers. We're going to discover, even with advanced funding and technology, that our knowledge, our capacity to gain knowledge about the universe will shrink. But they make the point, this is going to happen in every single discipline of science, art, music, literature, etc. Inevitably, knowledge must decrease. And the first thing they look at is knowledge storage. And so they make the point that there's a necessary degree of heat flow from hot bodies to cold bodies that's necessary to store information, to store knowledge. And I think all of us have experienced that here in the 21st century. I can remember when it would cost you more than $10,000 to purchase a hard drive that would store 10 megabytes. Matter of fact, I can remember when I was at the University of Toronto as a graduate student, they gave me special access to a massive storage device they had. They had this thing that was the size of an oil drum. It stored 2 megabytes. And at that time, I was consuming 25% of the computer storage capacity at the University of Toronto, and they had the largest storage capacity of anything in Canada. That was just 2 megabytes. And what do we have today? We, like the computer I got here, it can store 2 terabytes of information. And so we have this luxury of seeing with every year that goes by, we're able to store information to a much greater degree, much more rapidly, and with a lot less money. When we carry around these little flash drives that can store an entire terabyte. But Krauss and Starkman are making the point that that's going to turn around because to make these storage devices work, you have to have some means of transferring energy from hot bodies to cold bodies to make that work. And as the universe continues to expand, there's going to reach a point where it will no longer be possible to see increasing storage capacity, which means that we're going to have to turn things around and be content to store less information. So as the universe expands, and you can see here, we're only looking at like 1 billion years into the future, where we're going to see significant decrease in that. And as we go to, say, 10 to the 20 years, but there actually reaches a point where we're no longer going to be able to store any information at all. And so the knowledge that we have will decrease, and our capacity to learn is going to reach a point where we're going to have to use more and more energy. It's going to be more and more difficult to exploit that energy in order to increase knowledge. And so they're basically making the point, as the universe continues to expand, not only will we lose our ability to be able to store information and knowledge, we're going to lose our ability to gain any new knowledge, to gain any new information. And you know, people have read the paper, said this is kind of like that movie Stupid and Stupider, namely that humanity, as we move into the future, we're going to be condemned to become more and more stupid, more and more ignorant, lacking more and more understanding as time goes by, exactly the opposite of what humanity has been experiencing since we were created. So this is one of a depressing state. In fact, when I first read this paper back in 2000, I said, of all the scientific research papers I've read, this is by far the most depressing paper I've read. But it gets even more depressing because Krauss and Starkman make the point that even if you're going to exploit things that are happening at the quantum and relativistic levels, there reaches a point where it's simply going to be impossible to capture sufficient energy to be able to sustain metabolism, even at its lowest level. I mean, they made the point there are life forms on planet Earth basically living below the surface, well, the bottom of the crust of the ocean, the basalt ocean floors, where the metabolism is incredibly slow, where you've got bacteria there that have a metabolic rate that's 100,000 to a million, even 10 million times slower than normal bacteria on the surface of the Earth. But they're saying even that very, very low level of metabolism will be impossible. And that's going to happen in less than 10 to the 100 years. And incidentally, as I read their paper, they're always giving the maximum time. So it could happen a lot less than 10 to the 100 years. They said even if you exploit all conceivable technology, taking advantage of every possible physical concept in the universe, the most that you can sustain metabolism, even at an extremely low level, is 10 to the 100 years. And he said, with the end of metabolism is the end of life. So he says, no matter what happens, if the universe is all there is or was or ever will be, a time will come when physical life everywhere in the universe will cease. The universe will become sterile, where there's no life happening at all. And when that happens, consciousness ends. So there'll be no metabolism, no life, and no consciousness. And so, and basically they make the point, you know, with the end of all consciousness, that means that we humans have no kind of ultimate purpose, hope, or destiny, meaning, or value. We are no better off than a rock. We're no better off than a piece of dust. I think I mentioned 2 weeks ago, too, long before this happens, the protons decay. The protons are going to decay away in 10 to the 33 years. And if you don't have protons, you're not going to have atoms or molecules. So that's going to happen on a lot less than 10 to the 100 years from now. So yeah, this ranks as the, still today, as the most depressing paper I've seen published in the scientific literature. And it's not the only paper. There are other papers that have been published. Interestingly, all these papers that have been published by people who have a non-theistic worldview. I haven't seen a theist publishing these papers. It's all come from the non-theists. So they themselves are recognizing if the universe is all there is or ever was or ever will be, there is no ultimate value or purpose or meaning for human beings. And yet none of us can escape the fact that we do have this. You know, and I mentioned too in my debate with the particle physicist, Victor Stenger at Caltech. You can get a recording of that full debate at reasons.org in our store. And I would encourage you to listen very carefully to the very end of the debate because they give Victor Stenger the last word. After all, I was speaking at the Skeptic Society International Conference. And so, in fact, they reached a point where they told me to sit down. I couldn't field questions anymore. They said, no more questions for Hugh Ross. You can only pose questions to the non-theistic scientists that are up there. But they gave Victor Stenger the last word. And what he said there was, remember, you were all cold nothing. And I went up to Victor afterwards. He's passed away since. But I went to him afterwards. And said, of all the speakers I've heard today, you're the only one who's been honest about the ultimate state of a non-theistic worldview. Because all the other speakers who are atheists were basically saying, yes, there is no God, but that doesn't mean we don't have value, purpose, and meaning. We do. And Stenger's point was, that's nonsense. If there is no God, then we're all cold nothing. We're no better off than a proton, an electron. We have the same fate. Everything's going to have its end when the protons decay. So there is no ultimate purpose or value in humanity. But Victor Stenger was the exception. And by the way, we got along pretty well. I had some good conversations with him over dinner, before the debate and afterwards. And he himself told me, I'm only going to debate you if we set it up as a dialogue, where we talk to one another in a way that's friendly. And so that's what I want too. And that's kind of, I think, how we're actually going to get somewhere in these debates and dialogues. So I did appreciate that about him. And incidentally, he's written a number of books. And frankly, I believe he's probably made the best case that I've seen from any atheist scientist for an atheistic worldview from a scientific perspective. And also, he provided some great critiques that I compliment him on. He had two chapters in his book, God, God, the Failed Hypothesis. But he had two chapters on prayer and how research studies have shown that people who pray get no more than people who don't pray. And I said, what you wrote there is a really good critique, because what you were critiquing are all the ways we shouldn't pray. The Bible actually gives us some specific instructions on how we should pray and why we shouldn't pray in certain ways. And you are right in line with what the Bible is saying about the fact that if you pray the wrong way, you're going to see no benefits. And so that kind of got a good discussion going. It was all private. It wasn't public. And also the surveys he was citing involved people of all beliefs, not just people who took the readings of the Bible seriously. But where these other speakers were coming from, these other physicists, is that they were dealing with the issue you see in Ecclesiastes 3:11. He has set eternity in the hearts of all men. And, just like God has written his moral law on the heart of every human being, he's also written within us this sense, this knowledge, that there is something about us human beings that exists beyond the grave. And, I see this all the time. People who never go to church, who live their lives as a non-theist, when they pass away, everybody talks about them being in heaven. And so there's just this inescapable sense that there's something beyond just this physical life. And and then people are convinced that their lives actually have meaning and value. I mean, we're seeing that today in this whole racial issue here in the U.S. It's all based on this idea that every human being has value, has purpose, has meaning, has hope, and a destiny, and we should be encouraging that. But people are ignoring where that comes from. That's only a rational conclusion to draw if indeed there is a God, if there's a God that's created us human beings, not just to live these few decades here on this physical planet Earth, but to continue to exist beyond our life here on Earth and into eternity. In other words, the universe isn't all there is or was or ever will be. There is something beyond the universe. And this is where I really want to go in terms of where we take this this series, is basically saying, okay, if there is no ultimate hope, purpose, or destiny in this universe, and yet we can't escape the fact that all of us believe we have it, that it must exist outside the universe. And just like the degree of evil we see being expressed amongst human beings and nations, is too great for there to be nothing beyond the universe. There has to be something beyond the universe. And that's really the goal I'm trying to have here in the class, is get all of you to the point where you realize, okay, how do we get this conversation moving to take the problem of evil and suffering and actually use as a tool to prove to people that there is a God, that there is a good God, a God is not capable of evil, is basically to get them away from depending on the universe as their ultimate hope and realizing their ultimate hope must lie elsewhere. And basically making the point that God not only has engraved our potential and destiny in our hearts, he's imprinted it all over the cosmos. This is why I've spent so much of my life on the fine-tuning argument, and why in my latest books I'm making the point that no matter where you look in the universe, or where you look at any size scale, from the universe as a whole all the way down to fundamental particles, everywhere we look, we see that this universe has been fine-tuned. It's been designed to make possible the existence of us human beings, and not just designed to make possible the existence of our human beings, but to make possible our redemption from our sin and evil. Basically making the point, yes, we are experiencing sin, evil, and suffering now, but it is temporary. God is preparing us for a realm where none of us will ever experience sin, evil, or suffering again. But the whole point is that the universe cannot provide us with any possible hope, purpose, or destiny. And yet, all of us believe we have this hope, purpose, and destiny. In fact, I found that this is even true of Victor Stenger. He said, yeah, we're all cold nothing. We have no hope, purpose, or destiny. And yet he was on a mission. I mean, you know, Victor, why do you write these books? Why are you so intent on pointing out the errors and misunderstandings of people who believe in God? He has a mission. And he really does believe that his mission is to further good in the world. Well, where does all that come from? It can't come from the universe. And the whole point there is the Bible reveals a two creation model. And this is what I found unique about Christianity when I was going through the different religions of the world, is I noticed that other religions do speak about heaven, a realm beyond this universe. But as look at how they describe that heaven, that realm, it really was something that fit in with the physics of this universe. So for example, as you look at the heaven of the Muslims, it's a heaven that we can visualize within the physics of this universe. Likewise, what you see in Hinduism, Confucianism, Mormonism. The only exception I found was the Bible. The Bible was the only holy book I picked up that talked about two distinct creations with two distinct sets of dimensions, with two distinct sets of laws of physics. It wasn't a heaven that fits in with the physics of this universe. It's a heaven that replaces this universe. This is also something I found unique about Christianity. It alone taught the idea that a time will come in God's plan when the universe that he spoke into existence, he will speak out of existence. The universe is temporary. The new creation is a creation that will be eternal. And so the universe was designed by God all along to be a temporary means to move us from one creation to the next creation. And that's what Lawrence Krauss and Glenn Starkman have pointed out, is a temporality of our universe. Matter of fact, we talked about the Big Rip, how if the universe, one of the possible ends for the universe is it reaches a point where space and time itself begin to be shattered. And with it, that shatters all the fundamental particles in the universe. So the universe cannot be it. It's got to exist beyond the universe as a whole. And this is a unique feature of Christianity, is that it's a two creation model. So I kind of put that little, by the way, the first person to walk in space untethered, as you see here, he is a believer, he's a Christian. He actually spoke at one of our conferences, moderated one of our conferences as well. He has a doctoral degree in aeronautics and physics. And his name is Dr. Robert Stewart. He's also a general. But he was the first one to go into space untethered. And he says, it really does give you a feel of being apart from the rest of humanity and the rest of the universe when you're floating out there. But this is a unique feature of Christianity, that it alone is a two creation model. Now, one of the things I want to talk about next week is that, you know, as I've engaged atheist scientists about Christianity, and it's like, okay, if God created the universe, he created it to be a home for humanity. What they're overlooking is that God has multiple purposes in creating. In fact, I'm engaging a number of atheists on my Twitter site. And what I notice amongst all of them, they're saying, your God can't possibly exist because we see designs that are not optimized all over creation. And I said, well, yes, we do see that. We do see suboptimal designs, but that's because God is creating with multiple purposes. And so it's akin to what you do when you're buying an automobile. You can buy an automobile that's very efficient on gas, or you can buy an automobile that has very quick acceleration and can go 200 miles per hour. But you're not going to be able to buy a high performance car that's actually the best in gas mileage. There are trade-offs. And so, for example, you can purchase a car that's got really good gas mileage, not the best, but it's got really good performance as well. And so you basically make trade-offs in order to fulfill more than one purpose. And we're going to see that's the case with the universe. God created the universe. And next week, I'm going to talk about the 12 known purposes for God creating the universe. But the problem I'm seeing in engaging atheists, typically they only recognize one purpose for God creating the universe. Occasionally, there's some that say that there are two. And therefore, they claim there can't be a God behind it all. Well, they need to realize God's got multiple purposes. So kind of like our backbone. Our backbone is suboptimal for walking. It's suboptimal for running. It's suboptimal for sitting at a computer screen all day long being asleep. But it is ultimately optimal for being able to do all those different activities for hours at a time. The human backbone is an amazing design for all it can do for sustained time on a daily basis and sustained time on a lifetime basis. But yes, there is a way to make a backbone where you could run faster, but not a backbone where you can also run faster and sit at a computer screen all day. Anyway, we'll look at that next week. And what I want to do now is give you the URL. So we're going to have Q&A, and as always, you can ask any question you want. We'll take the Q&A up to noon, but come noon through to 12:30, we're going to break up into discussion groups, and that's going to require me taking you into a meeting. So we'll shut down the webinar at 12 noon and go into a meeting. Those of you who want to be part of that, this is the URL you need. You will not need a password. And so you can take a photo of this with your smartphone or any other kind of device you've got there, or you can write this down. The key part there, of course, is that /843-456-80354. So I'm going to leave this up for another minute. And when we end the Q&A time, I'll pop it up again, so that people who join us late can see it again. So if you don't get to write this down or photograph it, I will pop it up again. But this is the address, the URL you're going to need to go into those meetings.
You ready for your Q&A?
I am.
Tonette from the Atlanta area asks, what are your views on eternal security? I've heard it pointed out that John 10, 28 through 29 is evidence that no one who gets saved can ever get unsaved, no matter what they do. But how does that reconcile to Matthew 25, 31 through 46, in which Jesus speaks about sheep and goats? Also, there are many scriptures in which Paul lists sinful behaviors and says no one who practices such things will go to heaven. Where do you stand on that?
Yes, I wrote about that at some depth in the book Beyond the Cosmos. Let me see what, there's a whole chapter on it. Let me pull it down here for you. Yes, chapter 14. We're giving away chapter 13 free for anybody who goes to reasons.org/Ross. But if you get the book, chapter 14, whole chapter there on eternal security. And what I do in that chapter, it's the same practice I apply with all the other chapters. I give you all the passages that people cite to support the doctrine of eternal security. But I also give you all the passages that people cite who say that the Bible doesn't teach eternal security. So you get to see the pro and the con. And I basically encourage everybody, read all the verses first. And that will give you a sense of what's going on. But personally, I do believe in eternal security, that if a human is truly saved, has repented, and has submitted their life to Jesus Christ, asked them to forgive of all the sins that they've ever committed or will commit, and have made Jesus the boss of their life, basically making him number one in their life, and agreeing to allow the Holy Spirit to transform them. People who have really done that truly are born again. That from that point onward, they're guaranteed to have an eternal relationship with their Creator, a relationship that will become more loving and more fulfilling as time goes on. Now, what I've done in Beyond the Cosmos is I take you to all those texts that people cite to say that we don't have eternal security. And probably the most famous of those is Hebrews 6. Matter of fact, I'm going to turn to that passage right now and basically show you a principle we see here in these scriptures. Hebrews 6, and the passage that is cited is Hebrews 6, verses 4 to 6. Here we go. This is the passage that's cited by people saying there is no eternal security. One of the passages, the most common one. Verse 4 is an impossible for those who've once been enlightened, who've tasted the heavenly gift, who've shared in the Holy Spirit, who've tasted the goodness of the Word of God and the powers of the coming age, if they fall away, to be brought back to repentance, because to their loss, they're crucifying the Son of God all over again and subjecting him to public disgrace. And so people look at this text and say, you know, what's written here could only apply to somebody who is a believer. And it's basically saying they can lose their salvation and fall away. And when they fall away, there's no future possibility of them ever becoming a Christian. However, always look at the context and the point I'm making beyond the cosmos. Take whatever passage that people who deny eternal security quote and just say, let's read the verses before. Let's read the verses after and see what it says. Every single time, you'll see a disclaimer passage. In this particular case, it's in verse 9. You know, people stop at verse 6, they might read verse 7. You've got an interlude here in verse 7 and 8 about the land that drinks in rain and producing thorns and thistles. Basically, the writer here is giving us an analogy, a word picture. But here's a crucial passage, verse 9. Even though we speak like this, dear friends, we are confident that better things in your case, things that accompany salvation. And so the author of Hebrews here is making the point, what I just described for you in verses 4, 5, and 6 does not apply to a true believer. Verse 9 makes that clear. So what is going on in verses 4, 5, and 6? Just like the passages that Jesus was referring to, here the author of Hebrews saying, there will be people among you who have been fellowshipping with you. They become students of the Bible. They actually appreciate the benefits of the Christian faith, have experienced the benefits of the Christian faith. But bottom line, They do not want Jesus to be the boss of their life. We will not have this man rule over us. That's what you saw the response from some of the Pharisees. They knew exactly who Jesus was. They knew what his mission was, but it's like, we will not have this man rule over us. And so you see this throughout the New Testament, that we can expect there'll be people in fellowship with us who are really not true believers. They have the Bible knowledge, and it's because they have that Bible knowledge. It's because they know exactly who Jesus Christ is. It's because they know the benefits of a relationship with Jesus Christ that we see the statement here. If with all that experience and knowledge, if they reject it, there's no future opportunity for them to come to faith in Christ. It's basically describing someone who's committed blasphemy against the Holy Spirit. And so I tell people, if you're worried about your security, then you really are secure, because losing your salvation or losing your relationship with Christ, this passage can only apply to someone who actually knows what they're doing. We're not talking about somebody who's got doubts. They know exactly what's going on. So if you've got doubts, if you're concerned, the real point is, do you have within you the desire and the power to live the Christian life? I keep telling people, you know, sure, you may be struggling with sin issues in your life, but do you have the desire and the power to allow the Holy Spirit to actually work within you to gain victory? The person that this is referring to here in verses 4, 5, and 6 is like, they don't want to be delivered from their sin issues. They like their sin issues. They're not cooperating with the Holy Spirit to gain victory. They don't want victory. They want to live a life that's autonomous, independent of the authority of God. But you'll find a lot more details in the book Beyond the Cosmos. So, I'll bring this up again in the future, but let me actually stop the share, and we'll spend the rest of the time in Q&A.
Okay, Chris Thompson from Anchorage asks, could you please comment on the recent study published by Shuai Li about the hematite discovery on the moon? He found it is more prevalent on the near side of the moon, suggesting that Earth is responsible. Your thoughts?
Well, I've actually written a blog on this. It's not released yet. I'm trying to remember the date. It'll be a Monday in September, which will be released. I think it's going to be the 23rd. So the article's already written about this hematite discovery. And, what got the attention is hematite is basically iron oxide, Fe2O3. So it requires a lot of oxygen to make this. And it's like, you don't have the necessary oxygen content in the moon to make hematite. So this must have come from the Earth. And the fact that this has been found on the near side as opposed to the far side, that's more evidence that indeed this was transported from the Earth. And so the paper basically goes into, well, how do we explain the quantity of hematite on the moon? And basically makes the point that it's the oxygen in the upper atmosphere of the Earth that got transported through meteoroid bombardment of the atmosphere, comets and asteroids and meteorites bombarding our atmosphere and basically exporting oxygen from the upper atmosphere and depositing on the moon where it can form this hematite. But the paper ends with a single sentence. And basically I took that sentence and wrote several paragraphs on it because they just kind of let it drop. And I said, wow, they don't realize what they're really talking about here. Namely that this gives us an opportunity to get a detailed history of the oxygen content in Earth's atmosphere. Now, I published a graph in Improbable Planet, but there's a period of about 1.5 billion years where we really don't have really good oxygen records for the quantity of oxygen in our atmosphere. I'm excited about this discovery of hematite in the moon because that means that we could recover that hematite And there are ways we can date when that hematite formed. And that's going to tell us what the oxygen content for Earth's atmosphere was at the time that that lunar hematite formed. And we should be able to get a really precise record of the oxygen content in Earth's atmosphere. And I personally believe that's going to give us a really new opportunity to come up with fine-tuning arguments for the existence of God and God's control and operation of life on planet Earth because of how important that oxygen is. So, and I think it's actually going to affirm something I wrote about in a blog where they made a discovery in 2018 that there was a giant oxygen jump in the atmosphere just before the Avalon explosion where the first animals appeared on the Earth. I really think that this hematite discovery gives us a way to affirm that because we know it was rapid, but we don't know exactly how rapid it is. That hematite should give us the answer. Anyway, there's a blog coming out that you can read on that discovery.
Thank you, Chris. Yuvin has a question. In many of your talks, you mentioned about past sins causing us to feel the effects, and this experience is increased with the severity of sins. You mentioned this has to do with the law of thermodynamics, etc. I was sharing this with a friend who is exploring Christianity, and his argument is, this viewpoint sounds like karmic laws. How do we respond?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly the context here. I'm trying to remember what I was saying back there. What I was talking about was how thermodynamics, gravity, and electromagnetism are fine-tuned by God, designed by God, not only to enable us to live and thrive here on planet Earth in a physical sense, but they're also designed to restrain our expression of sin and evil. In the sense that these laws of physics are such that that when we commit sin and evil, we damage our environment. And it takes a lot of work to undo that damage. And it takes a lot of pain. And we waste a lot of time. And we are biologically designed that none of us enjoys a whole lot of extra work, extra pain, and wasted time. And so that actually provides a motivation within the laws of physics itself to avoid sin and evil because... you know, we benefit in the sense that if we avoid sin and evil, there's going to be a lot less pain in our life, a lot less work in our life, and a lot less wasted time, and we will be more fulfilled and have a more enjoyable life. That's just a consequence of the laws of physics. Something I shared with my sons when they were growing up, if I don't discipline you, the laws of physics will, and the laws of physics don't care. You're just going to suffer these consequences. Now, it's not quite like the karma. And incidentally, we need to realize that God has written his law in the heart of every human being. All human beings recognize the impact of thermodynamics, gravity, and electromagnetism. So it's no surprise that these truths actually permeate much of the other religions of the world. The difference is in Christianity, we can get help from the Holy Spirit. Because the Bible tells us, yeah, even though we have this high motivation from the laws of physics and the space-time dimensions, we still commit sin, we still do evil, and we still suffer the consequences. We can't seem not to do that. It takes the supernatural power of the Holy Spirit working with each one of us to step-by-step give us the victory, the deliverance from sin and evil. And you know, if you know people who have been Christians for decades, submitting to the work of the Holy Spirit, you notice there's a lot less pain in their life and suffering in their life and wasted time compared to people that are the same age who don't have a relationship with Jesus Christ. There are actual real benefits from living the Christian life. but my point is, you know, it's not karma. In the sense that one of the things you notice with people who really are committed to a life of sin and evil, is they work really hard to transfer the consequences to other people. So they live a comfortable life. Someone else has to clean up all the damage that they've caused. And we see this with despots throughout world history. They lived a comfortable life, but the people they ruled over really, really suffered. And the people they abused really, really suffered. And that's why God has established that there should be authority. We need government. We need police. We need an army. And those institutions are all in place to ensure that those who commit the evil are the ones that experience the consequences of the evil. That's the principle behind our prison system, is to ensure that the perpetrators of the evil are the ones that experience extra work, wasted time, and extra pain. Although in some prison systems, there's wasted time, but not the extra pain or the extra work. So, and the whole idea too behind a really good prison system is restoration. What can we do to restore that individual? And this is why I've noticed a lot of prisons are really open to Christian organizations to come in and work with their inmates to restore them to a useful place in society where they don't live a life of sin and evil. Matter of fact, a number of our Reasons to Believe chapters, that's their mission. They go into the different prisons and to provide them with reasons to believe and a hope for a life after they're done with their prison sentence. So that's the difference. What you see in Eastern religions is no matter what you do, you're going to be stuck with the consequences. From a Christian worldview perspective, there is real hope, but that hope comes from something beyond the physics of the universe. Hopefully that helps.
Thank you. We've got a question from Mark Durham in the Los Angeles area. For the past 2 weeks, the Los Angeles basin has experienced record-breaking heat, exceeding 120 degrees Fahrenheit or 49 degrees Celsius. Is this attributable to global warming?
We have been experiencing record heat, but I can remember times in the LA basin where we've had temperatures very close to that. And as I look at the best global warming models, they actually do predict that California, especially Southern California, will get warmer, but not as dramatically, for example, as the Canadian North. The Canadian North is warming about five times faster than the rest of the world. But I've lived here in Southern California long enough, I can remember back in the 1970s, when the snow levels in wintertime would drop down to 1,500 feet. I've never seen them in the last 15 years drop below 2,500 feet. So in that sense, I think we are seeing some of the consequences of global warming here in Southern California. I noticed too, we're struggling with droughts more than we used to struggle. But what's been happening here in California is somewhat minimal in terms of global warming. Yes, we are seeing it, but not to the degree other parts of the world are. And incidentally, there are parts of the world that are experiencing cooling. So Eastern Europe, for example, has gotten colder, but the global warming models actually predict that. You know, they use the term global warming for a reason. It's the average of the entire planet that's warming up. And with that average, you will get places that are colder, you will get places that are warmer. But if you average it all out, we're about 1 degree centigrade warmer than we were back in 1950. We are where we were back 8,700 years ago. 8,700 years ago is where you have the maximum temperature in this period of extreme climate stability. So we're back where we were for 8,700 years. The climate, global mean climate, was very, very gradually cooling. And it reached a minimum around 1950. And from that, it's gone back up by 1 degree. The big concern is, given the rate at which our technology is advancing and our wealth and population are advancing, we could well add another degree in just another 70 years. And there we run the risk of melting the summer polar ice cap. And I mentioned the consequences of that and weathering climate change. So yeah, we are feeling it here in California, but it's nothing like what my younger sister is experiencing in central British Columbia. She tells me that when she first moved there 35 years ago, she would get 6 weeks where the temperature would be between 30 and 35 below Fahrenheit. And she says now at winter, we never get below 0 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a 35 degree change. So much more radical than what we're experiencing here in California. Here we're talking temperature differences of a few degrees. It's not like the 35 degrees that you see in parts of Canada.
Thank you. Pablo from Costa Rica says, hello, Dr. Ross and everyone. In the Bible, do we find any reference to these universal physical laws or others that have not yet been verified? In the Apocalypse or another book, we have information how physically life can end. For example, a final explosion. And I guess that's a long question. Are there physical laws that are depicted in the Bible? And do they talk about how life will end?
Well, the only place I see where it talks about different kind of physics are the passages you see in Isaiah and in 2 Peter about how the universe will end. And I mentioned that in my teaching today, that you know God spoke the universe into existence 13.8 billion years ago. A time will come in the future when he speaks out of existence. And there are two passages in Isaiah and one in 2 Peter chapter 3 that tell us how God's going to bring an end to the universe, how he's going to wrap up the entire universe as a scroll, and it'll disappear in a fiery heat. And that seems like the entire universe disappearing into a singularity, where you have this universe expanding, but something happens where it suddenly all collapses into a singularity, a fiery heat, and it disappears. There's one Big Bang creation model that actually fits that description literally. I say literally because I know a number of Bible scholars who look at those three texts and say, look, it's only three sentences. We got to be careful not to put more meaning on those texts than they deserve. And they argue that those passages may be figures of speech, but it is interesting. There's one Big Bang model whereby the universe ends literally just that way. It's where you have the universe as an extended 10-dimensional flat sheet where our capacity to observe is limited to the flat sheet, but beyond where we can observe, the sheet folds in on itself and becomes kind of like a U, and this 10-dimensional sheet that folds back in on itself, you would have a top sheet and a bottom sheet, and those two sheets of the same sheet are close enough together, it's possible for a quantum space-time fluctuation on the top sheet to make contact with one on the bottom sheet. And if that were to happen, the entire universe disappears into a singularity. So that may be the way the universe ends. We'll see. That's the only place I know where I actually see something distinctly different from what we're observing today. I've written a lot making the point that a number of non-theistic scientists basically say, we don't need a God. There's some new law of physics we've yet to discover. There's a fourth law of thermodynamics, or in addition to the four fundamental forces of physics, there's a fifth force of physics, or a sixth force of physics. I've written that for life to be possible, for physical life to be possible in the universe, that there cannot be any significant additional force of physics or some significant law. There could be new constants of physics that operate at a level that have very subtle effects on the universe, but to have a major effect, if it has a major effect, it actually rules out the possibility of life in the universe. I've written about that in the fourth edition of The Creator and the Cosmos.
Thank you. LP Xiong asks, in your videos on YouTube, you mentioned the faint sun paradox and that Earth going back into an ice age, both situations ending human life. Which catastrophe will happen first?
Well, what are the two catastrophes? One is that we're going to go into an ice age. What was the other one? Mark, what did you see in the question there? Okay, well, I'll just take a stab at it, but I'm not sure I got the right understanding of the question. Namely that, yes, the sun's getting brighter and brighter as it continues to fuse hydrogen to helium, and eventually the sun will be so bright it's going to rule out the possibility of human life. And the reason why is as the sun gets brighter and brighter, in order to keep the temperature at the surface of the Earth at a level that makes physical life possible, we're going to need to lower the greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide. However, in order to lower the carbon dioxide level to a sufficient degree to keep the temperature of the Earth low enough for human beings to survive, that carbon dioxide level will be too low to sustain photosynthesis. And we need photosynthesis to be able to feed human beings. When is that going to happen? In Weather and Climate Change, I actually gave you a date. I forget the exact number, but I think it's somewhere like around 1.7 to 2 million years from now, the sun's going to be too bright. As to when we're going to drop into the next ice age, that's probably going to happen in less than 2,000 years from now, because the natural cycles are working to cool the planet. The only reason we're not in an ice age right now is that human activity is warming the planet at the same degree the natural cycles are cooling the planet. So we've staved off the onset of the next ice age. But there's a limit to how long we can sustain that. So we either melt the polar ice cap by warming up the planet. And if we melt the polar ice cap, that's going to bring on the next ice age. That's what you see in the ice age cycle. Global warming, if it's of a sufficient degree, always brings on global cooling. You melt the polar ice cap, you're going to drop a whole bunch of snow on Siberia and Canada. That will bring on the next ice age. When is that going to happen? I say we can probably put off the next ice age for another 1,500 years, but I can't see us putting it off for 2,000 years. So that will happen before the sun gets too bright for us to be able to sustain the photosynthesis. Okay, with that, I'm going to again share screen and give you some instructions here. Here we go. And you should all be seeing this slide, which gives you the URL for, we're gonna close down the webinar and move to a meeting. And this is the address, the URL you're gonna need to get into the meeting. And so I'm gonna get that meeting started. And when I do, we collect several of you, I'm gonna randomly put you into small groups. And the whole idea is to try to build some sense of fellowship in this paradoxes class. Encourage you to find out the names of the different people in your group, where they're from, what they do for a living or done for a living, and find out where each of you are in your spiritual journeys. And basically get to know one another, and every week you'll be put into a different group. Hopefully that'll help us to get to know one another. Something else I'm gonna try to do in the class too is a break up my teaching with short testimonies from some of you. So we'll be asking some of you to be willing to do that. So I'm gonna leave this up for maybe another minute in case you didn't see this before. And you can write this down or take a photo with your phone, and then I'll close down this meeting, and then we'll move in, or close down the webinar, and we'll move into a meeting. The webinar doesn't let me break into small groups, but the meeting facility does. That's why you're going to need this.
So Hugh, the procedure will be, you're going to end this meeting.
I'm going to end this meeting.
And then everyone goes to that URL and it comes into a new meeting. Is that correct?
That's correct, but you won't be able to get into the meeting until I start it. So give me a minute to get it started, then you'll be able to join.
Thank you. See you then.
Okay. So I'll give you guys 30 more seconds and then we'll end this meeting. All right. I look forward to meeting some of you. I'm going to be part of one of those meetings as well. So I'll see you on the other side. I'm going to stop share here. And we'll end the meeting and start the next meeting.